accession number 9227, reel 5.
Mr. Brown, reel 5. You mentioning escapes earlier on,
yes, yes.
You said that in the very early stages, one all did get away.
Yes, yes.
Did they go on a purely individual basis, or was there any encouragement, official encouragement, for people to try and get out?
No, there wasn't, no. Because the conditions they regarded were so bad that they were worried that reprisals would be such that it really wasn't worth the candle. In fact, they came along at one stage and asked us all to sign bits of paper to say that on no account would we escape. And there was great debates whether we should and we shouldn't. In the end, we were told we would have to, we would sign. And it was a general military order. It was, really wasn't worth what it was written on. But they threatened reprisals, and so it was decided. And in fact, it became very, very difficult. I mean, you've got to get across China virtually.
Did they actually impose any reprisals for the first wave of escapes?
I don't think they really knew they'd gone. It was the days before they really got complete control. And it was much later on, when there was one escape, later on, when they virtually brought the camp down by reducing rations and beating up the people who slept either side of him and so on. So that's when the replies took place. But that was much later on, when I say, everything had been settled and orderly for a long time.
You mentioned that Major Boone was very keen to cooperate with the Japanese.
Yes, yes.
Was there anybody else who took a similar sort of line?
Not directly, no. There began to be a black market. The thing was that there was a canteen came where if you had money, you'd do it, and the Japanese did in fact start bringing stuff and start giving officers money, pay, according to rank in yen. So you could get stuff in canteens, and in some cases one regarded it as a means of living, of life. I mean, there was some food. And of course, some people wanted more money than this was available, and so the guards were interested in buying things. In other words, one or two became go-betweens between the guards, and almost became black marketeers. And they used to get a rake-off. And this was often officers, not only junior ones. A senior officer would, in fact, have a contact with guards and would act as a go-between and flog stuff in return for something in return. Now, we all went to Argyle Street, all officers, and of course we found ourselves headless. Up to now, we've been a military organization, run as a military organization, and by and large, not doing too badly, because, I say, when you're in trouble, there's nothing like discipline and an organ to do it. We found ourselves, how do we run ourselves? All Lieutenant Colonel equivalents in the other two services. And we decided we'd have a camp committee, and that there would be a Lieutenant Colonel in the Royal Artillery, who would be nominally the chairman of the committee. It was a disaster. Because we could never agree anything. And if the Japs wanted something done, we would, the argument was, well, we're officers, we don't work under the Geneva Convention, and so we don't do it, or this, that, and the other. And they used to lose their tempers and start hitting people up, or cutting down rations, or one, this, and the other. And really, one felt one it was no good. And the kind of thing that happened was that typically, we realized that money meant you could get things with money, and therefore certain money was coming in. Wouldn't it be what about pooling all the money coming in for the benefit of all? A typical idea. But no, there was none of that. I mean, Lieutenant Colonel was an equivalent. No, that wasn't on. So we managed to raise a small fund for some batmen, the other ranks who'd gone with us in all three services, to give them something to go with. And in fact, money was saved to send back to Shamshupo for medical stuff for the traps and troops left behind. There was a fund raised for that purpose. But the idea of general pooling, was not on.
How was this committee formed? Was it elected?
Elected, yes. I would happen to be the lieutenant's representative.
So it's elected by ranks?
By ranks, yes. There was a representative of the batman of the other ranks, and there was a representative of the Army, Navy, and Air Force units by rank, yes. But as I say, it brought us more trouble than it was worth.
You found that the interests were sharpened rather than compounded.
Very much, yes. But in Argyle Street, we were there for some time, and we found a complete way of life. In fact, in Hong Kong, a complete community was taken prisoner, really. You had the volunteers, and you could get an expert on pretty well anything. Lecturers from university, doctors, anything you could think of. There would probably be an expert. We had two Canadian battalions. We had the volunteers, and they included white Russians who'd come down, the Portuguese. You could learn pretty well any language you wanted. And so there was a tremendous amount of study groups set up, lectures. But apart from anything else, we had to keep ourselves. And this wasn't easy because, for example, we were provided one time with flour. And all we could do at that time was boil. Now, flour is very difficult to deal with. In fact, we had the chap who ran the messing was a Middlesex major called Hedgeco. And he was called Robot Hedgeco. He was typically a kind of robotic type of character. And Hedgeco decided, well, we'd make dumplings. And so flour and water was mixed. Well, they were cannonballs. They weren't. But we decided then we must do something, and we'd have to have a bakery. Well, what do you do about a bakery? And so we made a bakery. We got bricks. We scrounged bricks. We built an oven, and then had to have a chimney. What to make a chimney out of? We found corrugated iron, and I spent many an hour beating corrugated iron with a brick to flatten it so that it could be made round into a tall chimney. And where did you get rope to support the chimney? Well, there was some barbed wire. And so again, I spent hours with others taking barbs out of barbed wire and splitting it up into its components. And we actually made a workable oven. We had a baker in the camp, and we began to get, when we had flour, we could in fact bake bread. But it wasn't very often we could do it, but we did. We got a certain amount of sugar coming in. Now, again, we were very lucky. We had the doctors, but no medical supplies. And so they immediately said, we began to suffer from things like deficiency diseases, beriberi and pellagra, and things like that. And this is entirely due to lack of vitamins. And so the sugar was taken with the doctors and turned into a yeast. And we used to get a spoonful of yeast mixture every day, which was a means of combating it. The other thing we were told was that we were allowed to grow to start a vegetable plot. Now, we were told this first of all when we were at Argyle Street, at Shamshu Po, and we were told our garden was, that was it, and it was nothing more than reclaimed land. It had been a parade ground. It wasn't a bit of earth in it. It was all decomposed granite. And so we started digging to make beds and found that nothing would grow. And then we discovered we'd got human manure, like Chinese. And so we began to collect urine, let it stand for a fortnight, and then started watering with it. And we found the faeces. The medicals agreed we could bury it in pits about 5 feet down. And then after a few weeks, when it was all hard and dry, we were allowed to bring it up. And we experimented on the bedside lawn, and we made a hole in this decomposed granite, which we'd loosened by digging, and put a little piece of this dried manure at the bottom. And boy, did you get marvelous vegetables. That's all it wanted. So, you know, we learnt. And the great thing, we could get tomatoes. There were quite a lot of people had contacts or Chinese outside who, throughout all the trouble, would bring parcels to them. And some of these contained things like tomatoes. And we were able to get the pips of these, and we started tomatoes, because tomatoes are a very good source of vitamins. And they grow like weeds. And so we concentrated on growing tomatoes and green stuff. And we got quite a flourishing garden going.
You're mentioning the black market earlier on.
Yes,
what
yes.
sort of things were being traded with the Japanese?
Fountain pens, watches, and so on. Things like that. The people were willing to buy. Later on, when we'd gone back to Shamshu Po again, continuing on this story of black market, there were a lot of the volunteers whose families were on Stanley, in prison there, And the Japanese did allow them to send yen across to their families. Now, they wanted more money because, I mean, the amount of pay some were getting wasn't enough to send to keep them, so they wanted more money. So they were willing to sell anything. And moreover, some of these racketeers inside our own camp had amassed an amount of yen, and they were willing to sell that yen in return for IOUs at extortionate rates of exchange. Now, by this time, my boss, the top man, had been sent off to Formosa because he was the colonel, but the lieutenant colonel left behind was a man named Galpin. And Galpin, with the chap in charge, decided this was wrong and we must do something about it. And so Galpin said if he would like to start a fund, and he said, I'm a treasury representative, I will, if people will let me have yen they don't want, I will then give them a promise to let them, they will be repaid at the end of war at a rate of exchange which I will determine, and anybody who wants to borrow from the fund for families, they will be, have the money at, again, a rate of exchange which we will say is fair. They tried to break him, the racketeers, to try to stop any money getting to him, but it was a lieutenant commander, I forgot his name, who actually sold his gold epaulettes. And he got enough funds in that, and from, I think, from another senior officer who also let something be sold for him, to start a fund. And that fund worked. As people flogged something, and they didn't particularly want the money straight away, they would hand it in, and other people who wanted it would take it out. And one of my colleagues, he kept the accounts meticulously so. When we were released, Galpin was flown back to UK. He took these accounts with him, and this is true. The British Treasury agreed that anybody who had taken money out of the fund, there was no question of any repayment at all. It was free, and anybody who had put money in the fund would be refunded at a reasonable rate of exchange. And that was done.
Did you get your pay coming through from England?
No, that was banked in England. I got none of that. That was kept in England.
You were mentioning the Japanese wanted you to work. What
Yes.
sort of work did they make you do?
Oh, they were construction. They were wanting the troops to go on construction work around the colony, roads and things like that. It was mostly construction work that they were doing.
And they wanted officers to do the same kind of thing?
Well, they initially. But this is a facet of the Japanese character, which one learnt, that at that time they were desperately to try to be thought of as a Western power, or on a par with Western power. They have a strange chivalry, martial chivalry, inbuilt into their nature too. And when our general said, well, look, you signed the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention, officers don't work. And there was a certain amount of hesitancy, you know, they didn't like to press it too much. The result was they said, well, if you don't work, you won't get a worker's ration, you'll get a short ration. And so that was the answer. We didn't get as much as men who were prepared to work. But they never carried it any further. And this we found often, you could work on the Japanese, work on their character, and get away with things. But you had to understand them and play on it. And it came off.
Did they show any signs of an attempt to understand your character and work on you in a similar way?
No. We were really were the lowest of the low. We were prisoners of war. We should never be prisoners. We found it in the Japanese army, for example. One of the reasons why a lot of us are alive today is because in the Japanese army, a man was never sick. To be sick was effeminate and weak. And therefore, they didn't bother about medical health in the Japanese army. A man was well until he was wounded. That was honourable, and he'd be treated. But if he had VD, if he had malaria, if he had dysentery, too bad. That was it. He was on his own. And so we began to find, I mean, we had no supplies at all, no medical supplies at all. They didn't give us any at all. We began to find that Japanese soldiers would come to a camp and say, look, we're aching and so on. Do your doctors know what, give us anything for it? And our doctors say, yes, you've got malaria, you've got VD or whatever it may be. If you get such and such a drugs, we can treat you. but will you also get some for us at the same time? And so we began to get a lot of vitamins for some of the bad cases of beriberi and pellagra coming in through the Japanese itself, just because of this feature of them really paying no regard. And so as prisoners, we were the lowest of the low. I mean, you should never allow yourself to be taken prisoner in Japanese eyes. And one had to begin to see things through Japanese eyes. This slapping of the face, they couldn't understand why we were so upset about it. And when you saw a Japanese guard formed up and the sergeant got upset by one of the guard, he would then set about him. He'd kick him and throw him to the floor and beat him up with the scabbard of his sword. This was normal treatment. And so, they couldn't really understand our reaction to what they regarded as perfectly normal treatment, particularly to unspeakables like us, who were just, we should never be alive. We were dishonorable people. The Japanese doesn't become a prisoner. So, there were these characteristics, and you just learnt to live with them.
How could you then persuade them? Was it just by pure argument, if you wanted to
persuade
them to do something?
Pure argument, yes, pure argument. And playing on this spirit of Bushido, of military chivalry. Didn't always work, but nonetheless, at times it did. Properly applied.
What sort of accommodation were you in at Argyle Street?
Argyle Street, this was a camp which had been put up for refugees coming across the frontier, which were put into a camp. It was hutted, wooden. We were about 40 to 60 men to a hut. By this time, we'd all managed to scrounge beds of some kind or other. They were mostly the old metal beds with biscuits, the old army type. And there's barbed wire around, but we always had plenty of water. So you had pollution, and the sanitary range was pretty good too. We had flush sanitation. Barbed wire perimeter all around, and that's it.
It sounds as though the Japanese weren't terribly interested in the internal administration of the camp.
No.
It was rather like an American prison in that they were interested in keeping you in, but apart
That's
from
right.
that...
Very little, no. They'd obviously be prowling around the camp, and as time went on, things began to happen. For example, news was difficult to get. Sometimes a paper would be coming with the canteen, and we had Chinese and Japanese people, of course, as translators, so we were able to translate that. And I didn't know until the thing had blown up. I used to walk around the camp with a New Zealander who was in the Wavy Navy. Now, he'd been a radio man in private life, and he'd been working in the Navy as a radio specialist. Now, I used to walk around the evening digger. He was a sailing man, too, and so we used to have a lot to talk about. And I found out later, I didn't know, although I was with Digger most days, that he had actually made a radio work. He, from a variety of sources, for example, he wanted a condenser for it. And so he asked anybody who had silver paper from cigarette packets to let him, he would like to keep silver paper. And so people gave him silver paper. And he made a condenser. He told me the first one he made. He didn't realize that he made it, that using a whole sheet, it had very small holes in it, and therefore it didn't work. So he had to take it to bits and go through each sheet and cut out pieces which didn't have any hole at all. There was in Onagawa Street, opposite us, what had been a Chinese market garden, which we were allowed to go over and work. And in it, there was an old Austin 7. And we prevailed upon the Japanese to let us have that Austin 7 in the camp, for a class on motor work. And from the engine of that, he got a lot of wire, he got magnets and so on, which helped him too. But he was really stuck with valves. That was one thing he couldn't make. Now, down the road from us, there was another camp which had Indians in, because they separated the Indians. And they, poor devils, had a bad time, because they were trying to encourage them to go over to them. And if any of us had to have an operation. There was no facilities in the hut at all, in the camp at all. We had doctors, and we had surgeons. But down in the Indian camp, there was a kind of medical room. And so if the doctors persuade the Japanese this was an urgent case for an operation, they would allow him to be carried down on a stretcher, down to the medical, to the room where they could operate the chap and bring him straight back. Now, one chap had a bellyache, and the doctors immediately said he got appendicitis, whipped him down, whipped his appendix. It was nothing to do with it at all. All they wanted was they got a message to the Indian camp. They wanted some valves. Some of the Indians had much greater, and they'd got them. They couldn't get them back. The only way to get them back was to send a party down. It was a medical party. And while the operation was going on, the valves were handed over. And Dicker made a radio. And he began to get radio messages. I mean, he began to get, not radio mail, but I mean, he began to get news. Now, we all tried to find something to interest ourselves. I mean, you just couldn't sit around doing nothing. And we all began to, and one of the things I just, it was shorthand. And I did it with a captain, the Royal Engineers, another friend of mine. We both did shorthand together, and we worked up quite a speed. And then the intelligence group said they'd like to know anybody who did shorthand, because they'd like to disseminate news, and they'd have a group of people, because they couldn't read, they couldn't publicize it too much, because the Japanese would find out. And so anybody, they formed about 10 of us who did shorthand. And we used to go and sit on the bed as if we were having a class, shorthand class. And one of the chaps who'd done the news would read it out to us. And we'd take it down, keeping an eye open for any Japanese around. And then we'd go back to our huts. We couldn't stand up our hut and read it. We'd had to go and sit at one end and read as if we were just reading something to a party chaps and disseminate the news that way. And we began to realize that the news was good. I mean, it really was good news. And I sincerely thought it was coming from Chinese and Japanese newspapers. I didn't know that this radio existed until one day we had a surprise parade. Japanese called us all out, and we were put on a parade, and they started searching the huts. And I remember Digger saying to me, "Bunny," he said, "I hope they're not looking for something." And they did, they found it. We reckoned there was somebody who gave them away. They found the set. It was, in fact, in a temporary location. What he'd done, he'd made a pit outside his hut and put a garden on top of it in a kind of tray. And that was lifted, and the set was taken inside. And when it was inside, he had it in a false bottom of a 4-gallon drum which held rice in, and normally. And he always had a bit of rice on the bottom. Now, he'd had it in for repair, and he hadn't had a chance to put it back. And they found it. They took 5 people out. In fact, they took 4 people out, all connected with it in one way or another. But there was a Lieutenant Commander Young, who was the senior to Dixon. And when he'd heard they'd been taken for this radio, he said to the Japanese, "Look, Dixon's not responsible. I'm his senior officer. I'm the man you should have." So they collared him too. They tried to prove that they'd been running a transmitter, which was a death sentence. But there were 5 military people, Navy or Army or whatever it may be, and they stuck to their story. And in the end, the Japs couldn't beat them down, so they were sentenced to imprisonment, and they were taken up to Canton and put in jail there. Now, in Stanley, the civilians also were caught with the radio. They took 17 of those, they executed them, because I don't think they were able to stick to one story under torture.
What sort of interrogation methods did the Japanese use in this case in Argyle Street?
Well, they took them out. And Digger, I went to see him in New Zealand last year, in fact. They first of all, started beating them up. I mean, hit them the legs and the head and just general beating up. Locking them up, making them stand for hours or sit for hours with their back up against the wall. No facilities at all, little food. Just general beatings and deprivations.
And who was doing this? Was this just the normal camp guards, or did they bring in...
No, they're the Kempeitai. Yes, no, these are the special police that they had. The Kempei. Digger said, I mean, you just had to... Nothing you could do about it, you had to take it. And he said, I mean, he said, he remember being taken up and there was Young... as he was being beaten about the legs and so on. I mean, he said at first you couldn't believe what was happening. In the end, he said, "You just learned to exist," and he came out alive. Just
what sort of conditions were they in when they went up to Canton?
Pretty poor. They were in a civil jail. But, he said, they formed a community. I mean, they were prisoners there, like murderers and criminals kind. But they all formed a community. And Digger said he learned how to pick locks. He said, I can get out of anywhere now, no problem at all. They learned how to pass things around. He said, I learned a lot there. He learned Chinese too. And in fact, when we got them out, especially when the war ended, because we knew they were there, and the forces made particular care to the Japanese, they got to be brought back, and they were. And I went to see Digger in hospital in Kowloon before I left. And while I was there, a Chinese came in and started talking to him. And when he left, he said, well, that chap's a bank robber. He's now decided he's going to get away before the authorities catch up with him. And we just come and say goodbye. They just had privation, that was all. They weren't tortured anymore. They were just locked up and in pretty appalling conditions.
What other sort of things would excite the Japanese to take these severe and harsh measures?
They executed five of our people, a colonel, and an officer of the Royal Scots, Captain Prasad, an Indian, who were, I found out later, not after the war, were in fact in contact with a group over the border. This was a group to come down and in fact did establish contact with the camp through lorry drivers coming in. Lorry drivers would come in with messages apparently hidden on the vehicle, and chaps would go and unload and bring us in. In fact, the camp was being advised to make a mass breakout. The idea was there would be a group would come down and assist, and there would be a mass breakout. I think the staff at that time were dead against it because they said the people were too weak to be able to do it. They just wouldn't be on. But they found out, and the Japanese then took the people concerned, who were mainly concerned with it, and they were all executed, beheaded or shot.
Where did they do that? In the camp or elsewhere?
No, elsewhere.
Was there any sort of judicial process before these executions, or were they just executed out of hand?
No, there was obviously some form of trial. We were not aware of it, but there was. And they were pronounced guilty. I mean, Digger, on his case, they went before a type of court. And he said, they said, is this your set? And he said they'd had added to it a transmission key. And he said, no, it's not mine. I said, why? He said, well, that's been added, that's not mine. And he stuck to it, and they apparently accepted it.
This was presumably the military court?
Yes.
What sort of security measures did they have?
They had a barbed wire fence with dannet wire at the bottom, and there was live wires running around, and lights at sections all the way around. And just guards patrolling outside and in the huts.
Did the guards often come into the compound, or did they mainly stay?
No, they came in occasionally. They walked round, yes. They did walk round, yes. Yes, they were inside too. And that was the time when if they didn't like you, then you'd like to get a slap or a kick or something like that. But the times of ill treatment was really in contact when, for example,